our software, what it allows us to do is not only view what all of the competitors in the area are charging, but it also will look at keywords from search. So for example, if all of a sudden people start searching self-storage in Rochester at a higher clip than usual, our system has the ability to increase the pricing because there's extra demand looking for our types of self-storage.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. We have a special guest here today. We have Hernando Angelucci. So he is the CEO and founder of Self-Storage. Syndicated equity. Is that right, Fernando?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Triple SE.
Yes. Triple SE. So thanks, man, for coming on to the show. Really excited and wanted to like learn more about your story. So, you know, before I go into it, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. What is Triple SE? And give us a little bit more about it.
Yeah. We are a self-storage development and operating company. It's a private equity company. We raise capital from retail investors primarily. We've done $250 million worth of self-storage across 55 facilities. That's in 26 different states. We have a little over 1,000 passive investors. We've produced on average high 50s. Internal rate of return for our investors. So doing pretty well. Wasn't always in the self-storage game. Started off in other real estate until I kind of saw the light and then got to where we are now.
Nice, man. So I'm real curious, like, were you, you know, because I did my own due diligence on it. What got you into the self-storage game? Was it just on, were you always into it? Did you pivot it? Like, tell me a little bit more how that transpired.
Yeah. So it started when I was 16 years old. I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And that book changed the way I thought of how to make money, time freedom, how to keep the money that you make. So talking about taxes and doing things on a tax advantaged basis. So I actually started off on the residential side of the business. So start off by wholesaling real estate. So what that means is putting a property under contract and then marketing that contract for someone else to close on the property for a fee, almost like brokerage, but not necessarily because you actually have to put your own money into the deal. Started with that and then very quickly made some cash, started putting that cash into rental properties. So single family homes, small multifamily homes. And very quickly, I realized that being a landlord is not a passive business. It's a lot of headache. There's a lot of things you have to worry about, especially if you're, you know, a landlord in states that gets really cold, like, you know, the city of Chicago, for example, that was negative 30 degrees the other day. You know, if the heater goes out, that's a life or death problem for that tenant, which means that you have to be on the horn, ready to fix it immediately. So what I ended up realizing is that in most real estate, your largest liability is your tenant. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that for my investors. So we decided to pivot. In 2016, started selling off all of our habitation-based real estate. So all of our single family homes, multifamily homes, and then starting on the contract assignment or the wholesaling side of self-storage. So once anytime I go into a new asset class, I always do the wholesaling first, because if I'm able to get a property under contract and sell it to someone that has way more experience than me at a higher price, that means I'm probably doing something right on my underwriting. So we started doing the wholesaling side of the business. And then in 2018, we opened it up for investors to come in and actually start buying self-storage facilities with us. So bought our first facility. And then, you know, 6-7 years later, here we are. We just bought our 55th facility on New Year's Eve, and that was in New York.
Wow. That's pretty good. Especially, I can only imagine, even with New York, like the rentals and so forth, that was the cost of it to be able to operate there. So that's impressive in and of itself.
Yeah. You know, we're kind of location agnostic as long as all of the financial metrics pass through our various levels of underwriting. So we don't really care where it is. What I will tell you is that certain locations don't work. Our underwriting just naturally kicks them out. And those are more the appreciation markets as opposed to the cash flow markets. So, you know, this facility we bought was in Rochester, New York. So not in New York City, but in a part of New York where it still makes a lot of sense. Really good cash flow. Had a great seller financing structure on that. So pretty excited about it.
No, I'm real curious, man, because I've I'm always so interested now because you're kind of seeing more. There's so much more just on the times we're living in of, you know, virtual companies, especially now that you're having to do with self-storage. So over the years, especially like of, you know, the digital transformation and so forth of having to deal with all the in calls that come in, handling all of the automation, have you and your team have had to pivot and adjust and, you know, really upgrade your cloud storage or anything else to help your infrastructure to be able to handle as more investors kind of come in to get their data and so forth? How has that been for you?
Yeah, it's been super interesting. So self-storage in general has been a laggard, if you will, when it comes to adopting new technology. We are now starting to see a shift in that mindset with the advent of a lot of tech companies coming into our space and buying up the vendors around our product. So the property management companies, the property management softwares, insurance, et cetera. And what we have noticed is that we are a company that likes to use technology, especially if it means less man hours, more efficiency, the ability to delegate if we have to. So here's a few examples of how software's cloud AI has helped out in our business recently. So number one, on the operations side, there's a company that we use now that has kind of three main selling points. The first is demand-based pricing. So something that the airlines have been doing for decades, self-storage has never adopted. And most of the owners out there still do not use this. Their price is fixed. Doesn't matter what time of day, doesn't matter what time of year, that is the price. Our software, what it allows us to do is not only view what all of the competitors in the area are charging, but it also will look at keywords from search. So for example, if all of a sudden people start searching self-storage in Rochester at a higher clip than usual, our system has the ability to increase the pricing because there's extra demand looking for our types of self-storage. So that's number one. Number two, which I think is fantastic, is the ability to allocate different rent increase amounts to different tenants based on their history, what they post on the internet for free, like social medias that are open. So for example, somebody that just posted a photo on their Instagram that's open that they're in the hospital and they end up, you know, they're paying cash every month for their unit and they're usually a couple days late every month, probably someone that's going to get scored lower on the ability to absorb a rent increase. So maybe anywhere between a 1 to a 3, maybe a 4. On the other hand, if you have somebody that pays automatically each month, it automatically gets drawn. It's on a Amex Platinum card and he's posting on his Instagram that he's on first class flights all the time going to Dubai and Europe, et cetera. Most likely our software is going to give them a score of a 7, 8, 9, or even a 10. And then what it does is it goes through that score of 1 to 10 and it will say, hey, the 1 through 3s, no rent increase. The 4 through 7s will moderate increase, maybe, you know, 7% or 10%. But the 8, the 9, the 10 will give them pretty heavy increases. So 20, 25, 30, 40% increase in rents, depending on where the competitor pricing is and what their history and online presence looks like. So it's wild what people put onto the internet for free, you know, that now my software could scrape and see, you know, what type of level are you at? Are you using iPhone or using, you know, 6 Google phones ago type thing, right?
Right, right.
And it will change the pricing. And then the third thing it does that I love is kind of the good, better, best model. So you want to rent the 10 by 10. I say, okay, great. 10 by 10 is $100, the lowest entry level. But that $100 is for the 10 by 10 that's on the third floor and it's the farthest unit away from the elevator. Now, if you want to pay $110, you can get third floor next to the elevator. If you want to pay $120, I'll give you the first floor next to the office. So still the same type of unit, but just doing this good, better, best. It's the equivalent of like, do you want to sit in the back of the plane? Do you want to sit in the exit row or do you want to sit in first class?
Yeah, right.
And some people opt to sit in first class, even though it's the same plane and they're going to the same location, they're going to arrive at the same time. So same thing with self-storage. So we're just now starting to implement these types of things in our industry. And we, as a company, have been one of the first to start using these. So that's on the operations side.
Yeah. No, you know, it's so, what do you think was the case of it, of why it's taken so long? Has it just been just with the ease of the adoption of the AI and for these PaaS services or, you know, for these cloud services that make it much more easier? Is it just with the time it is of, as you said, there's people bringing forward in the U.S. at least. I don't know how it is, how the laws are in Brazil with data control, but you think that's just with the times or what has been that shift that's held it back?
Yeah, I think the biggest shift has been that private equity companies are coming into our space and are buying a lot of the vendors that used to be in charge of these things. And they're bringing kind of their private equity team to these types of companies. So all of a sudden now they're getting more innovative. They're implementing things that in the past was not available to us. And then in addition to that is also the operators themselves wanting to learn how to use these systems. So when you look at the ownership of self-storage in the United States, almost 70% of that ownership are what we call mom and pop operators. They own maybe one, at most two self-storage facilities. It's not a professional company, not something that has a nationwide scale. They're most likely not implementing these types of technologies just because they may not have the scale to do it. And, you know, on average, self-storage owners are a little bit older, you know, 60, 65 plus, may not want to have the hassle of learning how to do this. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've bought self-storage facilities where they didn't even have computers there. Everything was on yellow legal pads. So you're going to ask some guy with a yellow legal pad that first he has to buy a computer, learn how to use it, then has to put in a management software, then integrate this, you know, AI automation. You think that's going to happen? Probably not. But that opens up opportunity for me where I can come in, pay him a fair price based on his current income, net operating income. And then when I own it, I can implement all these value add strategies to double the value of the property over a short period of time, 3 to 5 years. Right. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's, you know, first of all, money coming in and now starting to look at the space like it's a space that's worth it to invest in. And then, you know, we're seeing this large transfer of ownership from kind of the original two generations that were running these types of businesses to now kind of the younger generation like myself. I'm 34 years old, so grew up with computers my entire life, grew up with a cell phone in my hand. So implementing technology is a lot easier for people my age as opposed to someone that's, say, 70 or 80 or even we've bought facilities for people that were 90 plus years old, right? They just not in their acumen to use these types of products.
You know, it's so, you know, because now we're kind of moving through and, you know, there's a lot of hype, of course, around AI and, you know, of what all it can do. And there's, you know, there's so many different views of the conversation of what it can do, you know, of it's going to take all jobs and so forth. So, you know, you as a business owner, you've made so much success over 200 million, as you mentioned, of the transactions. Where at one point have you like noticed to where there's so many technologies, there's so many other products that you can utilize? Where was it that you, you know, either with your team or so forth that you picked on which is the right one, and how are you able to, you know, shift from that and make that decision? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's across almost every facet of our business, yeah. You know, every department. So here's another example, investor relations. In the past, you'd have to email each individual investor or give them a link to a secure Dropbox, their K-1s, their updates, everything. You'd have to match which K-1, you get them all from the accountant, you got 500 K-1s, which one goes to who. Now we have software, everything is housed in one portal. The investor logs in, they can make multiple investments, they can track all the investments from that one portal, they can find all their tax documents. For example, I get my K-1 and tax returns, I upload it into the system. The system automatically reads inside of the documents, the K-1s, and then matches it to the proper account. All I have to do now, instead of having to do it physically, I just have to verify that it makes sense, everything is in the right area, and then I click a button and then it sends everything out to those investors all in one button. So something that would have taken easily 5-6 hours to do now takes maybe 30 seconds, right? So massive time savings, which then allows me to run a more lean organization, which means higher profitability for my investors, right? Same thing on the marketing side. You know, the amount of technological advances we've seen in sales and marketing alone as an industry, and then applied to what we do. You know, think about the type of marketing that we do. We have, first of all, marketing for finding properties. So someone that wants to sell to us, raise their hand and sell to us. So there is technology and AI involved in the calling of the list, in the underwriting now, in the outreach, the passive outreach via email, text message, etc. And then also even for the analysis when we do calls. So when we do a call, our acquisition person will do a call with a seller. You have AI that's listening to everything, transcribing it, and then picking out key items based on the training set. So, you know, what are the underwriting criteria that we're looking for? Does this guy sound motivated? Does he not sound motivated? Is there incongruencies in what he's telling us, etc.? All of that. Then you have the other side, which is, so, you know, in addition to the sales outreach, then there's underwriting. We upload our underwriting into software. It does a bunch of stuff for us. You also have the other side, which is like the marketing for investors. So they need to like, know, and trust me. They need to be able to pick up a call, talk about an investment, say, yes, I'm ready to wire $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 to you. How does this work? Well, so this right here is a part of my marketing. We do podcasts. We cut them up. We use AI to edit. We use AI to transcribe, then to syndicate it across multiple social media channels. This gets it in front of the type of audience that I'm trying to get it in front of. And then they start to see my content from the social media sites that are using their own type of AI. So it's in every facet of our company, we've seen a massive shift over the last 12 months when it comes to implementation of new technologies, automations.
And I can only imagine, like, you know, and I've even been seeing it too, just with as we kind of go through, even now, there was about 2 months ago where we've had an statement of work where we needed to modernize for they're utilizing Microsoft 365 Copilot, and they were wanting to make the connectors between their Power Automate, like all of their different, their CRMs inside, because they were using Dynamics 365 for it. So it's the adoption took some time, but you're able to kind of showcase with clients now is even with mid-market on the side that's even still generating a lot of income with it is how to be able to assess the data and be able to, where can we utilize AI that makes it to where it's making an actual solution and an actual business impact within there. And, you know, it takes some time, but just even what you were saying is with the underwriters, the amount of automation, the workflows that goes into it is we're seeing this trend. And so now it's coming forward into how do we further optimize that over the course of time. So I'm curious on, Fernando, like what, like as you continue to scale, like what have you been seeing the tools that's really been helping you to explore like that, the scaling efficiently as it comes up?
Yeah. So we look at what is the most human intensive parts of our business. And those are always the spots that we're looking to automate first, right? So underwriting, very intensive. You know, there are some legacy products out there. Unfortunately, they're built on, you know, pretty incomplete data. So it doesn't make sense for our company to use those types of products. So we built basically an underwriting department from scratch. And then all of a sudden, we started to see new technologies roll out over the last 12 to 18 months. Things that will, for example, you can upload all your due diligence documents from a seller into that system. It will pull out some key numbers. And if there's anything incongruent, does the P&L match the tax returns? If so, why? If not, why not? Where are the issues? So now something that would have taken us hours to find, it can find in seconds and spit out a list of questions that we should go back to sellers and say, hey, this doesn't look right. What's the difference here? Is there something we're missing? You know, or, you know, is there fraud happening here,
right?
Which happens a lot with cash-based businesses. You know, we've run into a lot of sellers where we couldn't get financing on the property because his P&Ls were one number up here, and then his tax returns were another number up here because any cash payment he took, he didn't report, you know? And to get debt, you have to go off of tax returns. So a lot of things that can go wrong in the underwriting process, and it takes a lot of time, a lot of mental energy. So that's one piece. Another piece that we see all the time being very time intensive is just the personal relationships. I don't know if this is something that AI or agents can solve right now. It's probably a little bit too far from it right now, but maybe in the future, is the personal connection side of it. So let's say on the seller side, these sellers are selling a pretty large asset. You know, smallest ones we buy are maybe $1 million. On average, $3.5 to $5 million a piece. So, you know, this may have all of that owner's retirement money is trapped into this asset. So it's a pretty, you know, not only is it, they're not going to entertain tire kickers and people that are going to waste of time, or people that they think don't have the debt or equity backing behind them to get the sale done.
Right.
So that requires, you know, they're selling their baby to you basically. So how do you build the rapport? How do you stay in front of them? A lot of these, self-storage is not an industry that has a lot of distress. It's a pretty cash flow heavy business. So most people don't have to sell. They want to sell when the price makes sense, or there's some situation in their life where it makes sense to free up that liquidity that was trapped inside of that asset. So maybe they want to go travel. Maybe they have health problems. Maybe they want to spend more time with their family or kids or grandkids or great grandkids, what have you. That all requires rapport building.
Right.
And in addition to that, you know, the way that we set ourselves apart from a lot of our competitors is that we get extremely creative on our offers. So it's not just, hey, here's the price, take it or leave it. We make five offers. We say, hey, here's the price if we use a bank. Here's three separate prices if you stay in in the deal. Either you're the entire bank or you are 50-50 with an actual bank, or the bank takes the majority of it, but you keep, you give us maybe 20% of it as you being the second position bank. And then we do our fifth offer is like a rent to own. So we basically rent the entire facility from them with a pre-agreed upon price that we're willing to buy it from them down the line, 3, 5, 7 years from now. So all of this requires creativity, and it requires the ability to get information out of them, right? Why are you selling? Well, because I want the money. But why do you want the money? Well, because, you know, my granddaughter is going to college and I want to be able to pay for her college. Okay. Do you need, does her college charge all 4 years up front? Do you need all that money right now? No. Oh, you don't. Okay. How much does it charge? Is it quarterly? What if we structure some type of payment system around where we pay your granddaughter's tuition every quarter or every half year, every year when it comes, plus some walking around money for her and you. And that way we don't have to get a bank involved. Does that work? Does that solve the problem? So at first, you know, most people say, well, he just wants the money. But then you got to ask why, like an annoying toddler for like five times. Well, why do you want the money? Well, why do you want to give her the money? Well, why? You know, and you just keep going down until you right. can get some information that you can craft a win-win-win Absolutely. Situation. They win, they get a higher price, they get interest payments, their granddaughter gets their tuition paid for. We don't have to go to a bank. We get to pay lower interest rates, maybe have a better term, better loan docs, etc. So if there was a way to truly build that rapport using some type of agent or AI, that would be fantastic. But I guess that'd be more of like a, you know, you got to beat the Turing test, right? You got to convince someone they're not talking to a computer. Right.
It's so interesting, man, because it's really so simple. But even when we're dealing with, you know, technical discoveries, when we're trying to look into, you know, a client's environment on their infrastructure, it's really asking the right questions. As you said, it might sound why this, why that, but you're still going through the frameworks of, okay, what's going on right now, getting an assessment, what is the goal that you need to get to, and then what's stopping it. And then we just go deeper and deeper, and it uncovers more pieces enough for us to craft the right strategy. As you said before, sometimes folks just, okay, I know what you're doing, here's what we need to go through. But that builds more, as you said, the rapport, that builds showcasing that you're really a partner with them and you're really you want their benefit. So it's absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. That's what we do the same. You know, I saw as well, now I'm only going through the internet, you guys have, SSSC has done like more of a funding launch. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So we actually just launched our first fund. So prior to this, how we've raised capital with our, you know, 1,000+ investors is what are called single asset syndications. So we go out, we say, hey, we're buying this facility in Rochester, New York. Who wants to invest in this facility? Or we're going to go build this facility in Atlanta, Georgia. Who wants to invest in this ground up build? What we're doing now for the first time is we're launching a fund. So it allows for depreciation. It allows for diversification, not only across geographies, but investment strategies. And then on the top of that, it's what's called the GP fund. So it's a general partnership fund. So the investors actually get to sit beside me and Steven as if they were the sponsors on the project, and they get part of the promote. They get asset management fees, you know, development fees, acquisition fees. So we're pretty excited about it. We just launched it. The capital raise is going well. It's going to be a small fund for our first fund. It's a $15 million target fund with a $25 million hard cap. And then once that one is full, we'll move on to fund two. It seems that there is a lot of interest in this fund strategy. I always tell people, you know, some people like to invest in funds. Some people like to invest in individual assets. It really just depends on how you do your underwriting. So are you someone that likes to bet on the horse, which means you want to underwrite every deal and decide if you want to go into that deal or not? Or are you someone that wants to bet on the jockey? You want to say, hey, if I trust Fernando to do his underwriting and pick the deals. And so that works because on our single asset syndications, the minimums are a little bit lower, but on a per deal basis, they're a lot higher. So for example, if you want to come into my Atlanta deal, it's $50,000 per ticket, right, to come in. And that's one deal for $50,000 that you get access to. Or you come into the GP fund that has a $100,000 minimum, and that fund may do 10 to 15 deals. So now all of a sudden you're spreading $100,000 across 10 to 15 deals. You're only putting up, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 per deal. So you're able to spread your investment dollars across different strategies, diversify across different geographies. So it just really depends on, you know, how the investor invests, yeah. What makes them feel comfortable. And we're still offering both. So we still have the single asset syndications. The GP fund invests into the single asset syndication as the general partner.
So I'm like, with you guys doing this, you know, it's still relatively early. Like, what are the at least for yourself, as you being the CEO, what are the biggest lessons that you said you've learned from like raising capital across this wide spectrum?
Yeah. So I always tell people that there's stages. It's almost like peeling the layers of an onion. So in the beginning, you start with like your own money, and then you quickly run out of your own money, and then you go to family money or friends money, friends and family, right? But then very quickly, you run out of their money, and they're investing because they believe in you. They don't even need to look at the deal. They're saying, hey, I know Fernando's a successful guy. I've seen him hustle. I know he's going to do well by me.
Jockey. Right.
Then very quickly, you run out of their cash, and they start talking to their friends because they're getting a good return. So all of a sudden, you know, they're at a poker, you know, someone's at a poker game or at a wine club or whatever. And they say, oh, you know, what have you been making on your stocks? Oh, really? Like, here's my return with Fernando. And they say, oh, I would love to meet Fernando. That sounds interesting. So now all of a sudden, now you're getting money from friends of friends or friends of family. Okay. So those three circles, you, friends of family, and then friends of family, you run out of that money really fast, very, very quickly, because most people don't have very wide networks. They're very deep, you know, very deep relationships with a small amount of people. That's when you need to go kind of to the next level and you jump up to what we call your retail investors. So accredited investors, usually they have a net worth of over $1 million, excluding their home, or they've made between $200,000 to $300,000 for the last 2 years in a row, depending on if they're single or married. That's two of the 20 ways you can qualify to be an accredited investor, but the most likely ways that people get accredited. Now, these people, they don't know you. So it's not that they trust you. Now, what these people are doing, they're looking at your track record that you had with your friends and family and friends of friends and friends of family to see if you are a good bet based on past performance. Now, obviously, past performance is never indicative of future performance, but it can give you a feel of the direction and how they manage these types of assets. This is a huge jump because these people don't know you. So how do you get over that trust gap? This is where you start doing podcasts, you start going and doing speaking engagements, you got to show yourself off as an expert, you got to highlight the deals that you've done, you got to do press releases just to get them to call you, right? They got Fernando's phone number, now they're going to call me. And the funny part is, you know, I've been doing this for so long now. Now that, you know, easily I have probably 200 hours plus of video and audio of me talking just like this on the internet, split into, and then each of those split into bite-sized pieces that go onto every different type of social media channel. So I have sometimes investors call me and say, Fernando, I know this sounds crazy. I know we've never talked, but like, I feel like I know you because I've listened to 20 hours of you on podcasts and I know your core values. I know the way you invest. I know how you underwrite. I know how your deal's going, et cetera. So then all of a sudden, it's an easy sale because they already know who I am and I'm so online everywhere that you can easily find almost any information about me anywhere on the internet. Right. And then so that trust gap is closed. And then it really comes down to, okay, logistics. How do I invest? When can I invest? Let me know and I'll send in the cash. So that piece right there, if you could jump from friends and family up to retail investors, already you're going to be more successful than 90% of the business owners in the United States. Because the biggest problem for business owners is they don't know how to raise money. And if you don't know how to raise money, that means they usually pay someone else to raise money for you. And that's extremely expensive. I mean, just in my space, broker dealers are charging anywhere between 8 to 15% of the equity they raise. So if they raise, you know, $100 million for you, that means you got to stroke them a $15 million check. That's super expensive.
Right.
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 Whereas I'm spending, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month on social media and editing and way cheaper, but right. It's not immediate. It's a process that you have to build up over years doing this, you know, consistently, just like how you do your podcast, right? Something you got to get up and do it every day. You can't take a 6 month hiatus and hope it's all good. It's not going to be good.
You know, so you brought up a good point, man. Like, so do you think that, in your opinion, do you think that is where that might be the gap in between, but what separates the successful from getting that next level money is the consistency? Like, what do you see that you think from you're working with other entrepreneurs and what you're seeing that they're missing or what they could do to help with that?
Yeah, it's building the marketing funnel. So real estate businesses in general, you're actually running three businesses. You have a marketing business, you have an operations business, and then you have an investor relations and investor servicing business. So you have to treat those like three separate businesses. They need their own personnel. They need their own process and procedure. Also, it's not going to work. And the key to almost every business is either, or business failure, I should say, is either you don't have the customers you need right now, or you don't have the money to get the customers that you need right now. So both of those are a money problem and a marketing problem. If you have the money, you need to get the customers. So easiest way to scale is to have ready money available at a reasonable cost. You know, you can always find someone that's willing to charge you, you know, 30% interest, which is ridiculous. But you know what? Most people use that every day. You know what it is? It's a credit card. Get charged 26 to 30% interest all day, every day, because that's easy, fast money, as opposed to having to doing the work to build up a system where you can get money at 6% or 7%, right? For us, our, you know, most of our typical syndications, we're targeting a high teens to mid 20s internal rate of return. That is a lot cheaper than going to some type of vulture fund or vulture equity company that is going to take 95% of the profit and stick us with 5% and we do all the work, right? So building out, I think it's so important to learn not only how to market to find money, but then also how to close those people. Great books if you need recommendations for the people that are listening. Orrin Claff, How to Pitch Anything, great book. If you need to learn how to raise money, there's a bunch of books on syndication out there, the technical aspects of it that are fantastic. It's a whole new business. I think it's called The Greatest Book on Real Estate Syndication. There's a bunch out there that are really good. So I recommend people read, because, and you know, businesses have lumpy cash flow. Always. It's very hard to find businesses that have very smooth cash flow every month in, month out. And usually those businesses are, you know, they don't really produce very high multiples on net worth. So it may require a lot of work. So businesses that are lumpy, that requires something to smooth that cash flow. And that's always going to be outside capital.
And it just goes to, and you know, you're seeing it from that side, from the, again, from the leads. And, you know, my mind looks to the automation, the connection of the technology between those three pieces, and getting the analytics, getting the pieces, utilizing, if, you know, business owners, if they have a database of, you know, their customers or their leads, and how do they go into that, you know, utilizing either Sales Navigator, ingesting that data to help with finding, you know, new folks to be able to do for the donations or for the investment. So it goes into the absolutely of your case of it, man, on that. You know, I'm real curious just on with Fernando, just on how you guys have projected and, you know, going through this funding. What do you see for the next year that you'd like to see for SSE?
Yeah, so I'm assuming probably over the next year, we'll raise anywhere between 15 to 20 million.
We're typically, like last year, we raised, I think, close to 10 million bucks. So we're slowly going up. But that is allowing us to go after larger and more profitable deals. The larger the check writers we have, you know, when it was friends and family, you know, people were stroking $10,000 checks. Now that we're at the retail investor level, you know, I believe our average check size is like $135,000. Now that we're getting ready to jump to that next rung, which is kind of sub-institutional, family offices, registered investment advisors, wealth managers, then we need to prepare how our IR works to take on those type of check writers, which is usually, you know, $5 million minimum checks or $10 or $20 million checks. So now you're really into that, you know, private equity space. And that comes with its whole other set of reporting and compliance. And, you know, these are all things that 10 years ago, every time you moved up a rung, you'd have to hire 2, 3, 4 new guys to help run that part of the business. Now you're starting to see less and less and less need for physical man hours because of the automations that are going into the space.
You know, I'm real curious, just even as it continues with the workflow automations, now with the utilizations of sub agents within AI, being able to track and be able to focus more on different, you know, segments, as you said, with underwriting, either with investment marketing, you know, moving forward. So I'm real excited even see where you guys are, you know, next 6 or even just 6 months on the side of that. Real curious on, no, I wanted to ask you, I really had a good question, so forth the side, okay, but it'll come to me later on. So as we kind of close out, man, for now, I usually kind of ask this for everyone prior, but with it going through, you know, implemented what, you know, I like to call like these rocky moments for entrepreneurs, or even with, you know, new executives that come on, like CTO or CFOs trying to make a name for an enterprise level of, you know, what was that, those moments of how you've gotten through to these next stage to where you are now? Sometimes people, you know, give up, or there's a consistency. So for you, from your experience, what have you think that's really helped you to become now a leader in this space, say?
Yeah, number one is just constantly being a lifelong learner. You have to be constantly educating yourself, and there's ways to do this. So, you know, depending on your budget, start off with books, start off with free information online. But obviously, the more you pay, you get into different rooms where different types of information being shared, more expertise information. So one of the things that I read a long time ago that I really loved was allocating a percentage of gross profit, not net profit, gross revenue to education and learning. So start small, start with 1%, right? And you have to spend that at the end of every year, no matter what. So in the beginning, when it's a small business, it may be buying books, it may be going to a weekend seminar, et cetera. But then very quickly, you start scaling up and you need to start getting into rooms where there's people playing at a higher level. And these rooms sometimes cost a lot of money. So for example, business masterminds, I've been a part of masterminds that were up to $35,000 a year just to be allowed to go. And that doesn't count, you know, the quarterly flights and hotels and a week away from the business to be in these rooms with these guys that are going through the same types of problems that you are, because this accelerates your learning so much faster. Because not only you're learning from what other people have learned, but even better, you're learning from other people's failures without having to go through those failures yourself. That is a huge leapfrog ahead of most people. And most people think, man, that's what a waste of money to spend $35,000 to have the right to go buy a room and a hotel and a flight to then go talk to people. But the people that I have consistently seen advance quickly, including ourselves, were the people that go into these types of rooms, into these business masterminds. So that's number one, is get educated. And then number two, you got to learn to sell. I mean, we are selling ourselves all the time, literally 100% of the time of the day, and you just don't realize it. Anytime you meet somebody new on the street, anytime you're talking to a potential significant other, your family, you're trying to sell yourself or your ideas. And this also transfers into business. People do business with people, not with companies. The person they're talking to gives a vibe that they're not trustworthy, or they don't know what they're doing, they don't know how to present. That is not going to bode well for you. So just like everything else, it is a skill. It is not innate. There's no such thing as someone that's naturally outgoing. You know, I was not a very naturally outgoing person when I was younger, and I was kind of awkward. And I read books on literally, one of the books I read was literally called How to Talk to Anyone, 99 Tips and Tricks. I think it's Leo Londes, is the another one I read is The Definitive Book of Body Language by Barbara and Alan Pease. So these are all skills, these interpersonal skills that people think are just innate and people are natural. It's not the case. You got to learn how to do those things. And I think that's one of the most important things that you need to do if you have a, you know, exterior facing role of any kind. If you're talking to investors, if you're talking to clients, customers, you know, if you're talking to your own team, these are super important. So that's what I recommend. Get educated. That's number one.
I love that, man. It's been phenomenal. Even with going to those $35,000 pieces, even from the, you know, the engagement that you learn from those, but it's more important, as you said, it's those networking connections, those referrals that you get of building that, because those are in. So it's crucial. At the end of the day, as you said, it all comes down to human trust, right? And then building upon that. So no, I loved having you on, Fernando, man. I wanted to ask guests this as well, you know, and if you had a magic wand and coming through with utilizing of AIs that's increasing, let's say ChatGPT 10 or, you know, 15, what would you have it do, rather in your personal or in your business? What would you want AI to do?
Yeah, I've been hinting at this the entire podcast, but it's that interpersonal connection and rapport building. So have you ever seen the movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix? And
Yeah.
Once we can get an agent that acts like, what was that actress? Who was it?
Did the voice? I know you're, from the Avengers.
I know people are screaming at me.
Scarlett Johansson. That's what it was.
Yes.
Yes.
Once Scarlett Johansson is a real life AI that can convince people to fall in love with her, that will change sales organizations forever.
For sure.
The amount of time building rapport of any sales organization is one of the largest pieces. And guess what? That is one of the most expensive, from a company standpoint, one of the most expensive pieces of the company is the salespeople, because usually they're getting paid a base plus commission. So they're making, you know, I was told my sales guys, like, if you're not making a ton of money, that means I'm not making a ton of money. So I need you to make a ton of money because you're commission based. So once there's the ability for someone to call a number and think they're talking, you know, if I can make a clone of Fernando, which I know there's already some cloning services out there, and I have a bunch of content already out there, so maybe I can't try this to clone myself, but make a clone of myself. And then someone could call a number thinking they're talking to me, but they're just talking to an AI agent that can quickly build rapport, quickly run numbers in front of a person, give them an offer and get them to sign a contract. Man, it's going to be game over.
I know you already know with Matthew McConaughey's that's the big thing now of even utilizing, getting the licensing now of where you can utilize AI. Now it's paying you to use that voice as an assistant. That's the next steps of where it's going, like with 11 Lab, but with other places. So as you said, implementing that in, not only for the voice actors or whoever else is paying, but for that, for the leads, it's going to be a game changer. So I'm really excited to see. And I believe that's going to be fairly soon, man. So Fernando, this has been great. I know it's really good conversation and really a lot of good nuggets that you feel like brought in just on the, I don't know, on the entrepreneurial side, but even for capital raising. So I appreciate you coming on. So, you know, for the listeners that are coming in, they want to learn more. They want to learn more with the funding or just more and getting more involved with, you know, learning more about who, you know, self-storage is. Where can we find you at? Or, you know, for social media, where can we look for you?
Yeah, if you're listening and you're more of an aggressive outreach person, you want to talk to me right now, this is my real cell phone number. My real cell phone number is 630-408-8090. So 630-408-8090. If you're more of a passive outreach person, maybe you're listening to this at 2 a.m, you know, probably don't call me at that time. You can if you want. I most likely won't answer though. Then what I'd recommend is going to our website, ssse.com. So samsamsamedward.com. And there you can see everything that we've done, our track record. You can learn, you know, all of the podcasts I've ever been on, including this one will be there. You can learn more about us. And then if you want to reach out, you can schedule a time to chat.
And we'll make sure for the audience listening in, you'll see in the description. We'll put that in there so it'll be easy for you to check out. So Fernando, man, thanks again for coming on. Yeah. For folks listening, thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage powered by Solinox. So we'll catch you guys next time on the next episode. Take care, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more no fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at solinox.net.